Many people know the story by now, how a 19-year-old Harvard sophomore started Facebook in his college dorm room. Ancient history. That was 2003. Nearly a half billion people now use Mark Zuckerberg's social networking site. Still, Facebook has yet to make a profit, and there are many questions over privacy raised by users and now some governments. David Kirkpatrick is the author of a new book, The Facebook Effect. Good morning.
Good to be here.
Before we get to the privacy issues, I'd like to talk a bit about Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. You had amazing access to him. What's his worldview, and how does that shape what Facebook is?
Well, he sees the world as increasingly opening up on and off Facebook. And from the day he first created his system, he had this ethos of sharing that he strongly believed in. You know, the history of humanity has basically been in villages and small towns. And in that context, people pretty much knew each other's business. It's very interesting to me that a system created by a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, which is all about sort of getting inside the business of your friends, has emerged just at the moment when we're all moving to cities, because it actually suggests that we can maybe make this transition and retain some of the same dynamic we had in the small town.
And the investment firms are saying that Facebook is worth over $10 billion. What exactly?
More than that, actually. The latest transactions put it in the $25, $26 billion range.
It's extraordinary. So what's so valuable?
Well, in the United States, where about 125 million people use Facebook at least once a month, the average of those Americans, according to Nielsen, is they're spending 7 hours a month there. So you have 125 million Americans spending 7 hours a month, and then you look at it, it's 500 million worldwide. You know, this is just something that you can't disregard. It's a massive, massive way that people are spending their time.
Well, I must say, reading the book, it's very clear that the money part of this almost came as a surprise.
Well, I think if there's a theme to the book, the theme is that Zuckerberg is not building a business. He's building what he considers to be a social movement. And I really do think that's what he thinks. Now, he does think they'll make money over time. It's just that he doesn't make that his priority. The way he's always looked at it is, let's get ubiquity, and once we do, then we'll figure out how to, quote unquote, monetize this thing.
Let's talk about some of the bigger ideas that surround this notion of privacy. Zuckerberg talks about transparency. It's the utmost importance, he says. What he is talking about is you can't have two personas, the professional face and your
right.
personal face. How realistic is that?
Well, that's a really tough question to answer. I mean, he says, and I have a whole chapter, as you may have noticed, which is subtitled, You Have One Identity, which is a quote from him. And he believes that he will live a better life personally, and all of us will be more honest, and ultimately it will be better for the world if we dispense with all of that facade. That's his personal belief. But it's quite interesting that someone holding that belief has succeeded in building a system that 500 million people use.
You do write, though, that 30% of employers have rejected applicants because of things they found on Facebook.
So Facebook or other social networks.
So there's a
yes.
consequence mm-hmm. to having one personality.
Right. Well, I think, frankly, anybody who puts secret data about themselves on Facebook or any place on the internet is naive if they think it's not potentially going to get seen by others.
You have some remarkable examples, which raises questions about personal responsibility. For example, the new head of British intelligence.
I love that example.
After yeah. he was named, it turned out that his wife had been posting pictures of his children and details of his address.
Right.
Prison guards who friend prisoners. In trials, jurors who have posted opinions on Facebook during deliberations.
Right.
You don't have to post that. Do you think that users have something to learn as well?
Well, they definitely do. And you probably also noticed that there's a legal scholar who wrote a long paper last year in which he said he believes a large percentage of what we consider privacy problems on Facebook are what he calls peer-to-peer privacy violations, where our friends, quote unquote, are the ones exposing data about ourselves in ways that we don't like.
One of the themes of your book is the privacy issues are not new, and they've been quite heated with Facebook users over time. Do you think that this is a way that this community, everybody who's on Facebook, is beginning to determine what exactly privacy is?
You mean it's sort of a user-generated decision-making process?
Indeed.
In effect? Yes, we live in an explosive world of data production, and much of that data is about ourselves. And there's not much we can do about it with the extraordinary, you know, marketing apparatus that exists to try to target us both on and off the internet. And we all just act so much digitally. We create data about ourselves at a phenomenal rate. So, you know, I think there's another side to it. There's a certain anonymity in obscurity. As the quantity of data about us grows, the fact that any given piece of data about us might be exposed in the world probably becomes less problematic over time, because similar data is increasingly being exposed about everyone else we know. Therefore, it's less remarkable. And I think whether or not Facebook continues to grow, I think that's going to be the case. And we almost certainly will be less concerned about privacy more and more as time goes on.
Is it possible that it will be governments and not the U.S. government that will push more on this privacy issue?
Well, a number of them have already. You may have noticed just a week or so ago, the Pakistani government was considering shutting down Facebook in Pakistan because there was a group called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. And that was considered sacrilegious by Muslims in Pakistan. And Facebook actually ended up removing the group, even though technically it wasn't a violation of its terms of service. You know, when you have a genuinely global system like this and all the different value systems that it encounters in being global, I think it's quite amazing all the challenges it's going to face from government. And as I end the book, I say clearly, and I do believe this, there's no way Facebook is going to avoid substantial regulatory pushback in many ways because of the exposure of data, because of the way that it's trying to become an identity sort of infrastructure and maintaining even what might be considered a passport for the internet, when that sort of function has always been done by government in the past.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
David Kirkpatrick is the author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. For more information on successful social sites, one example, how one man used Facebook to take on Columbia gorillas, go to our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
In Nashville, the tourism industry has been working overtime to clean up flood damage in time for today's big Country Music Association festival. From member station WPLN, Blake Farmer reports.
Cheryl Burns pressed on to Nashville with her tour group from Australia despite what they saw on the news. She was concerned by the pictures of furniture floating inside the massive Gaylord Opryland Hotel.
It was like, oh wow, are we going to be still going there? And we were really worried about Opryland, and we'd heard that it was underwater, and probably, is it still?
No standing water, but it will take more than $200 million to reopen the hotel. 1,000 guests for the CMA festival had to find other places to stay. City tourism officials worked to fight off cancellations. CMA is the Black Friday for Nashville tourism, even in a good year. Die-hard fans come to see artists like Carrie Underwood and maybe snag an autograph. Sharon Eckenrode and her husband drove 7 hours from Ohio primarily to hear the former American Idol star on the Opry stage, which buckled in the floodwater. The concert had to be moved.
But that's okay. We'll come back, and when it reopens, we'll be back again.
The city will need many more repeat visitors to pay for a flood repair bill that's well north of $2 billion. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep with Deborah Amos. We're going to look this morning at the fallout from the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It is dominating hearings on Capitol Hill, as we'll hear in a moment. Also, BP's stock plunged to a 14-year low yesterday. Investors wondered whether the company could pay for mounting cleanup costs. BP says most of the costs should be taken care of by the end of 2010, but experts say if history is any guide, the cleanup will be measured in years. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Rick Steiner roars through Barataria Pass off the southern Louisiana coast. Rust-red slicks of crude oil swirl past the bow of the inflatable skiff. For two decades, Steiner was one of the lead biologists studying the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. He's an environmental activist now, working with Greenpeace. He suddenly realizes that we're surrounded by a pod of bottlenose dolphins.
And these dolphins are all being exposed in the water. They get it in their eyes, they ingest it. Sometimes they actually even inhale it, so they're all being dosed.
The chopper rumbles overhead, part of the massive effort now underway to sponge, suck, skim, and shovel up all that oil. We can see dozens of shrimp boats using their booms to gather surface oil. A small army of workers patrols the beach in white contamination suits. After the Alaska spill in 1989, Steiner says this kind of full court press went on for years.
In Prince William Sound, they had to do 3 summers worth of cleanup, and then they realized that there was no net environmental benefit to continuing.
The debate over how long this cleanup should go on is likely to get complicated. BP has already spent $1 billion responding to this crisis. In an interview with BBC Television last Sunday, CEO Tony Hayward promised to do whatever it takes to make the Gulf Coast clean again.
That's an absolute commitment, and we will be there long after the media is gone, making good on our promises.
But BP has also predicted that major expenses for the cleanup and oil removal will be finished within 6 months. Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen seemed to agree, suggesting that large-scale cleanup operations might end as early as this fall. Then, in a briefing at the White House on Monday, he offered a clarification.
Dealing with the oil spill on the surface is going to go on for a couple of months. After that, it'll be taken care of. I agree with you. Long-term issues of restoring the environment and the habitats and stuff will be years.
Some leaders along the Gulf Coast say BP and the Obama administration have tried to downplay the magnitude of the cleanup.
They have underestimated this from day one.
That's Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise.
And they don't realize how long lasting this cleanup could be. I think it could be a long time. I hope they cap the well tomorrow. But if they do, you've still got 6 weeks of oil in the Gulf that are going to continue moving on shore.
One of the big questions here is how clean the Gulf should be, or can be, when this is over. All those workers are removing a lot of toxic oil, but they're also tromping over sensitive habitats, disturbing shorebirds and turtles and other wildlife. At some point, that does more harm than good. Dr. Moby Salangi heads the Institute of Marine Mammal Studies in Gulfport, Mississippi. He says scientists aren't sure yet how to define success.
They might be able to take care of the superficial, you know, the tar and all that. That's obvious. But what we're looking for is a lot of the issues in the food chain and the ecosystem. It's going to take quite a bit of time, quite a bit of study before we can give it a green light.
This question of how long the cleanup might take isn't just academic. The tourism and fishing industries along the Gulf Coast are in limbo, hungry for solid information about when their lives might get back to normal. Byron Enkelade, president of the Louisiana Oystermen's Association, says he's not optimistic, especially if hurricanes push the oil further into coastal wetlands.
It could be years and years, especially in the oyster situation, where you would never be able to fish oysters with chemicals coming off the land. On high tides, it would come in. You'd have that oil constantly going over those oyster beds.
In Alaska, survey crews still find pockets of crude oil from the Exxon Valdez, and scientists still debate whether that cleanup ended too soon. The recovery here might be helped by the fact that the Gulf is much warmer and the oil from the deepwater horizon much more dispersed. That means in time, more crude will simply dissolve away into the air and water. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann.
Now we go to another big tourist destination, Hawaii. It has wonderful beaches, but some young people who live there feel the state does not have much in the way of career opportunities. As part of our series on new graduates setting out, Ben Marcus of Hawaii Public Radio reports on a Hawaiian who's hoping for better prospects on the mainland.
At the University of Hawaii commencement ceremony, graduates were separated and lined up by college. Ryan Cam remembers making an observation to his fellow liberal arts grads.
So yeah, when we were in line, you notice the different colleges, and then you see like the people that are a really short line for the College of Engineering. Those are the people with jobs, and people in our line, people without jobs.
He was simply stating what everyone around him was probably thinking. 22-year-old Ryan says his work experience likely won't help much either.
I mean, I have like a background in retail, which is an equally useless skill because it obviously doesn't take much to ring up a cash register, you know?
Also, there isn't the kind of diversity of jobs here you'd see on the mainland. tourism dominates, and it offers few opportunities or upward mobility, especially for history majors. So the lifelong Hawaii resident has set his sights on a city a world away, New York. Over his shoulder, a subway map is pinned to the wall of his Waikiki apartment, a souvenir from a semester he spent at Queens College.
Oh, I think you start to really fall in love with the city, this, you know, the more time you spend there.
For Ryan, the allure of New York City's culture and history exceeds any job opportunities the city may offer. Oh, and his girlfriend lives there. Surprisingly, none of this worries his parents. The Cam family gathered one Saturday evening for pizza at their home in Kailua, a sleepy beach town 20 minutes outside of Waikiki. Ryan's dad, Frank, who's a musician, says he's not concerned about his son's future. Exactly the opposite.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited because I want to see what happens because, like I said, he's the kind of guy that can make things happen.
In between bites, his mom, Diane, who's a massage therapist, adds that Ryan has always been a meticulous planner. She calls his move to New York a fantasy, and she means that in a good way.
Planning ahead, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to go, and you're like, yes, go for it, go, son, go, you know? Do all the things that, of course, we dreamed of when we were kids but never carried out. I always had that aspiration.
Diane joined the Navy out of college because she couldn't find a job with her business administration degree. While stationed at Pearl Harbor, she met Ryan's dad, who had a gig playing his guitar at the base, and she never left. Diane labels her family solidly middle class. Ryan's grandmother helped him pay for college, leaving him with no student debt. Not too long ago, Ryan told his mother something that hit her hard.
He said he wants to be in a better position when he's our age than we are. So that's like every parent wants their child to do better than they did. Every generation has gotten better. And so now we're at that point where this generation, they don't know if they're actually going to be able to do better than the parents did because of our economy.
In fact, economists say this is possibly the worst job market for college graduates since World War II. That doesn't deter Ryan. He still plans to leave for New York in August. He'll try to work for a year, put money away, and apply for law school.
As far as I'm concerned, evading the real world for a little bit is not a bad idea, especially with the current economic climate. Law school is a great way to kill time.
He hasn't had any bites on the resumes he sent out so far. He's not picky. He's open to working almost anything until law school. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.
Tomorrow, as our series continues, we'll meet one of the lucky ones, though his success did require a change of plans.
I wanted to work for Lehman Brothers, but then, you know, that kind of didn't happen.
So we'll find out what he did tomorrow on Morning Edition.
A California environmental group has found amounts of lead in bottled juice, juice boxes, and packaged fruit that exceed federal limits for young children. Sarah Varney of member station KQED in San Francisco reports.
It's the kind of taste test that parents dread. Over the last year, the Environmental Law Foundation, a nonprofit based in the Bay Area, purchased dozens of brands of juices and fruit products around California and sent them to an EPA-certified lab in Berkeley. And what they found was unsettling. Many individual servings of apple juice, grape juice, packaged peaches and pears, and fruit cocktail, all lunchbox staples, contained lead above the daily limit for young kids. Those limits were established by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. David Shard is a senior nutritionist at the Center for Science and the Public Interest, a consumer advocacy group that tracks food safety issues. Shard reviewed the testing results for NPR.
If someone is making unfortunate choices in the brands that they're buying and serving their children, this could be a cause of concern because they might be getting more lead than is healthy for them.
The tests were particularly troubling because the levels were calculated on a single serving, not the multiple juices and packaged fruits that an average five-year-old might consume in a given day. And there's no questioning the potency of the substance involved. Lead has long been known to cause physical and mental developmental problems. Megan Schwartzman, a family physician and associate director of the Center for Green Chemistry at the University of California, Berkeley, says children are especially vulnerable.
Their brain is not mature. Their nervous system is not mature. All of their organ systems are developing rapidly.
The products tested range from nationally recognized brands to more niche market favorites, but the results were troubling across the board. A single serving of Rayleigh's private label premium apple juice, Santa Cruz organic Concord grape juice, and Dole pear halves each contain levels of lead beyond what federal regulators consider safe. In a written statement, the West Coast supermarket chain Rayleigh's said the company was surprised by the lead levels since its suppliers and private brands routinely monitor their products. But the company says it has ordered independent tests to check for lead. A spokeswoman for the J.M. Smucker Company, which owns Santa Cruz Organics, said the company did not have enough information to investigate the claims being made. The environmental group says it undertook the testing to see if the kid-friendly juice and fruit products were complying with a California law that requires manufacturers to post safety warnings on products if they exceed lead levels set by state scientists. The group has sent notices of suspected violation of state law to California's Attorney General, Jerry Brown. The foundation's president, Jim Wheaton, says that such tests can go a long way toward changing company behavior.
Once pressed by things like California's law, people find ways to get the lead out and they reduce the exposure so they don't have to give a warning. And that's a good result.
All of this gives Shard from the Center for Science and the Public Interest a glimmer of hope.
If you look at the apple juice, is that there are some manufacturers who manage to avoid the lead entirely. And it would be interesting to find out how they're managing to do that. Are they choosing different fruits, fruits from different farmers who have avoided lead contamination of their products? Or do their manufacturing processes, are they of such a kind that they avoid adding lead to the food that they're processing?
The FDA would not comment on the foundation's findings, though a spokesman confirmed that the federal limits for lead were last updated nearly two decades ago. In the meantime, many scientists, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, now say that there is no safe level of exposure to lead. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
More than 300,000 fans from all over the world are expected to attend the World Cup in South Africa. As Anders Kelto reports, some cities are going to great lengths in South Africa to clean up their images.
Just a few blocks from Cape Town's new Greenpoint Soccer Stadium is Sea Point, where high-rise hotels stand atop old stone walls at the ocean's edge. Families and tourists stroll through the area's grassy waterfront parks to the sound of a kalimba. It's beautiful here, and that's partly because of what visitors don't see, the dozens of homeless people who normally live in this area. With the World Cup just around the corner, Cape Town police have begun arresting homeless people who live here, and in some cases, relocating them to the outskirts of the city. Shane Raymond is a homeless man who eats in a nearby soup kitchen.
There's this little area just outside of Cape Town near the airport that they call Blikkiesdorp, and that is where they are moving these people to.
Blikkiesdorp is about 45 minutes outside of Cape Town. The name is Afrikaans for Tin Can City, and it's easy to see how it got the name. There are hundreds of identical metal shanties laid out in perfect rows. Children and dogs run through the area's maze of gravel roads. There are 300,000 families in Cape Town awaiting government homes, and Blikkiesdorp is supposed to provide temporary shelter for many of them. But most people here are never issued a home elsewhere. Natasha Floor says she lived in a field near Greenpoint Stadium for 14 years before a social worker brought her to Blikkiesdorp.
I ended up here when that lady, she just come and throw us here because she's a social worker in Greenpoint for us was outside. And then she just dropped us here.
Gavin Brooks and his three children were brought here from Sea Point.
We feel like we are thrown away here. The government just threw us away. It's like a dump.
Cape Town officials deny that anyone has been moved to Blikkiesdorp against their will. Hassan Khan is on the board of the City Improvement District, and he also directs The Haven, a night shelter for homeless people.
I think there is a misunderstanding here. It is quite possible that those people, for themselves, didn't think they had any other choice of housing than going to Blikkiesdorp. But if the implication is that they were forced there, then I would have to say that that's not possible in a democratic country.
South Africa wants to present itself as a top tourist destination to World Cup fans. And ridding the streets of homeless people seems to be an important part of many cities' preparations. In Johannesburg, one official bluntly acknowledged the city's intention to chase away homeless people, saying, "You have to clean your house before you have guests." According to local reports, more than 800 people in Johannesburg have been arrested or relocated. And similar actions are supposedly taking place in Rustenburg and Durban. In a country where the forced removal of millions of black people during apartheid is still a recent memory, these relocations are especially controversial. Back in Cape Town's Central Business District, Pastor John Philmon runs a soup kitchen that is filled with homeless people. As the meal ends, a group begins to sing and dance. The people here are excited about the World Cup. The City Improvement District has provided them with televisions so they can screen many of the games here. Pastor John says he hopes the opportunity to see the games is an attractive lure.
The homeless people were always excluded, and they were not allowed, you know, on the premises or near the places where these big events take place. But now we've created an opportunity for them also to be part of the World Cup.
Those who have remained in the city will be safe here and out of sight. For NPR News, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town, South Africa.